Good afternoon. The court's ready to proceed. Are you ready?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Delia Clark on behalf of the firm Roland Henderson for the appellants John Witt and Sutton Bus and Truck Company. This matter arises from an automobile accident of October 9, 2001, where a collision occurred at the intersection of DuPont and Delaware Avenue in Wilmington, Delaware. John Witt disregarded a red stoplight and entered the intersection, striking the vehicle in which was being driven by Marie Vogt. Plaintiff was transported to and hospitalized in Christiana Hospital for 5 days. She sustained 8 rib fractures and complained of low back pain, as well as there was a pneumothorax. At the time of the accident, Ms. Vogt was a senior in high school, and there's no question that her senior year was disrupted as a result of her injuries that she sustained in this accident. She testified that she missed her musical tryout, that she failed to make all-state chorus, that she lost time from school, that her grades suffered, and that as a result of that, she was waitlisted at Salisbury State University. Later, she was diagnosed with a herniation at L5, a small central herniation at L5-S1, and piriformis syndrome. And much later, in May of 2003, or 5 rather, she was diagnosed with a sternoclavicle contusion. At the conclusion of the trial in June of 2005, the jury awarded $800,000 for these injuries. Our first argument is that the trial court abused its discretion in failing to reduce or the award or order a new trial. A review of the facts and the nature of the injuries show that this award is grossly out of proportion with the injuries and that it should have shocked the trial court's conscience and their sense of justice. We have ribs by the testimony of the plaintiff that healed within 6 weeks of this accident. By March, she reported to her medical providers that she was 85% better. There were, at the conclusion of her treatment, when she was released on a as-needed basis, Dr. Blue did not restrict her from any activities. And in fact, the plaintiff testified herself that she does everything she did before this accident.
But she does it with pain.
But she does it with pain, that's true, albeit she does it with pain.
So we're talking about a young woman facing a lifetime of pain.
And what the description of the pain was that after riding her horse, her low back was sore.
So you're saying that, well, you know, it's not a whole lot of pain, so who cares that it's going to be for, what, 60, 70 years?
No, we're not saying not, so what? We're saying that it is... She should be compensated for the some pain, but when you look at the totality here, that she's able to do everything that she could do before this accident, and in fact does do after this accident, that the $800,000 is excessive. It doesn't really add up. I mean, one would assume that if she is in significant amount of pain, then she says, well, I can't do that any longer. And I'm not going to put myself through that. So one would assume then she is not in a significant amount of pain and that it is enough that, yes, she notices it, but it doesn't prevent her from doing it.
I thought she said somewhere that sometimes she feels like she's 85 years old.
She said that on occasion that she wakes up, on some morning, she wakes up feeling like she's 85 years old.
Well,
so she testified.
Unfortunately, I have some relatives who are 85 years old and, you know, hearing from them, it doesn't sound real good, the kind of pain that you have when you've got problems like that. So, you know, the jury system is set up so that the jury decides what's an appropriate amount, and the court doesn't interfere with that except in an outrageous set of facts, right? Shocking the conscience.
And we believe that this does shock the conscience. When you look at her testimony and you compare it to the medical evidence that was established by Dr. Ballou, Dr. Ballou said that on the first date of his examination of September of 2003, that the only positive objective or positive finding that he had in that examination was that there was minimal tenderness at L5-S1 with palpation. That's basically a subjective finding. And then even in December of 2004, when he examined her, the positive finding as for pain in her low back was a positive finding for deep or minimal tenderness with deep palpation at L5-S1.
So what would you say is a fair range of compensation for having a disruptive senior year?
We're lucky sometimes that we can, as lawyers, we can look at it kind of academically. What would I say for a disrupted senior year? I would say that for the last 5 months of her senior year, it was disrupted. So what are you talking about? Usually, this is if you're equating with going to physical therapy, et cetera, et cetera, $2,000,
$3,000 a month. Someone who might have had their heart set. Getting into college, not being on the waiting list, someone who had their heart set on being in the all-state chorus and didn't make it, you know, someone who lives their whole life in anticipation of having it climax with a great senior year and has all of it pulled out from under them. And when you present that to a jury, what's a range? You know, juries, what do you think would be a fair range for having that disruptive senior year?
I would go with the $2,000 or $3,000 a month for that year. The issue is that maybe she had her heart set on getting on the all-state chorus, but there are a lot of factors in why somebody has chosen to get on all-state chorus, and the fact that you were in it the previous year is not a guarantee that you're going to get in it the next year. That's why they have tryouts every year. So I would submit that, yes, it's nice to say, and that's an excuse and improbable, could be. But there's no real evidence from all state chorus representatives that that's why she wasn't chosen that year. There might have been better singers, quite frankly. She may not have gotten on the musical. She may have tried out for the musical, but she might not have been right for the part.
And you started out telling us to look at this first issue as abuse of discretion, and then we kind of moved over to shock the conscience. So, and with regard to reversing on your first issue, are we saying that the trial court abused its discretion in some way, or are we saying the record should have shocked the conscience of the trial judge?
It should have shocked the conscience of the trial judge. And by his not recognizing that, that was an abuse of discretion and should be reversed.
Right. And do you want to move on to the second issue?
Sure. It's our contention that the golden rule was invoked in the closing arguments made by plaintiff's counsel. When counsel asked the jury to place themselves in the shoes of a party to a suit in arriving at a verdict and to render the verdict as they would want to be rendered in a case that they similarly situated if they were involved, it's a reversible error when the trial court fails to give a cautionary instruction. And in this case, the golden rule stands for the fact that jurors are supposed to be disinterested evaluators. And once you ask them to be an interested participant in it, they cannot be unbiased at that point in time. And the prejudice or the emotional reaction will be there, and their jury verdict will be tainted by that.
Well, in this case, in the argument that you're challenging had a couple of parts. One part said, you know, she went through the red light the green light when it changed, just like you do and like everybody does.
That's correct.
And let's suppose they left out, like you do, and it, the argument had simply been, she went through the light when it changed green, like everybody does. Would that have been permissible?
It would be probably close to being impermissible, and the reason I would say that it would be better is she went through the dry. I think the better way to phrase that would be something to the effect of she went through the light changed green and she proceeded.
Right.
Asking everybody else to do it. The reason that you don't.
Excuse me.
Oh, sorry.
And the reason I'm asking is because eventually they're going to be instructed on the law. And the law is going to say the standard is what would a reasonable person do under the same or similar circumstances. So the purpose of my question is, if you prevail, and that's the instruction the jury is going to get, what's a proper argument that you can convey to the jury about a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances if it isn't she did what everybody does?
Well, what everybody does is not always the reasonable, prudent, careful person standard. Quite frankly, if you said everybody travels, she was driving 55 in a 50-mile-an-hour like everybody does, that wouldn't be reasonable and prudent and careful. So that's why you can't use that argument. You can't let the jurors think that a minor discretion is what the reasonable, prudent, careful person would do. That's why we, in the law, have this fictitious person that we call the reasonable, prudent, careful person, or what we refer to in law school as ORP, the ordinary, reasonable, careful person. I think that in answer to respond to your question, I think the better way to do it is simply not use that analogy at all. And the better way to do it is to say something to the effect of Marie Vogt sat at a red light. The light turned green. To her right, all she could see was a parked bus. She proceeded through the intersection, and bam. What did she do wrong? You decide. You avoid all of any implication of asking them to place themselves in that position because, quite frankly, human nature is we don't like to admit mistakes. And so if you place yourself and you think, well, I've been in that situation myself and that I have proceeded on the intersection and maybe I should have waited the 2 seconds or 3 seconds before I went, but I did.
Did the jury find that she was negligent in this case?
They found that she was contributory negligent.
But it was not a proximate cause of her injury.
That's right. And that I find interesting because, again, we don't like to admit, human nature, again, doesn't like to admit mistakes. And so, therefore, if they found proximate cause of the injury, then they would say, we're partly responsible for causing our own injury. And we don't like to do that. I mean, even when we're at home and we're putting up a light bulb and we're reaching high and we're on a chair and not a ladder and we fall off and we kind of think, we'll say to a friend with a lot of chagrin, I was kind of stupid, I got up on a chair. But we admit that very hesitantly. And that, again, is why the jury shouldn't be asked to place themselves in the position. One of the problems I have with this is that you're, and with the appellee's argument, is essentially they say, well, even if you assume it's only on damages that you can ask the jury to place themselves in position, I think that's wrong. And the reason for that is because once you ask them to put themselves in the position, are you then asking them, step aside, now you're dealing with damages, and you're not in their position, in the plaintiff's position. You can't do that. Once the bell is rung, it's rung. And that's what, in fact, happened here, I think. That there's no question that there was something motivating the jury, this passion, and it started with this argument, or didn't start it. It concluded probably with this argument that you're, we do. It's constantly repeated, and it's different and important to note that it's McNally in the McNally case where suppose you. It's a different illustration. They're asking them to think of it from the point of view of the plaintiff. But even then, the comment of the court was that these comments were ill-advised and they borderlined. And here they're asking it, we. And in fact, he says, what did she do wrong? When we stop at a red light, when we start forward, we cross traffic, now facing us. We don't go to a stop. Traffic moves, and that's what Marie did. And if you're at an intersection, there are cars in the intersection, there are people, and, I mean, you can't just gun it. You're allowed. You have the green light. But now, when you have a green light, you're entitled to go, and you're entitled as a reasonable person. You're entitled telling the jury, you're entitled as a reasonable person to assume that other people will obey the law. And again, that's not really what the instruction was. So when the judge failed, when Mr. Counsel noted this and said to the court, listen, this was the golden rule, and the court said, well, I don't think he crossed the line, and he failed to give a cautionary instruction or even reiterate and say, ladies and gentlemen, I want to be real clear. You're not to view it on what you would have done in the circumstances. You're to view it from the reasonable, prudent person standard and repeat the negligence instruction. He might have cured it, but he didn't do that. I'm sorry, I see that my time
is up. That's the time you reserve.
Yes.
You can continue or reserve it.
I will continue. Essentially, the third argument is about the comment, the question that was, what are your concerns for your daughter's future? That is entirely irrelevant, and the court's ruling on overruling that objection was wrong. And it was wrong because what does one person's concerns about another really matter in the fact of how this accident has affected the daughter? We would submit to you that every parent is going to have a numerous amount of concerns. And when you look in light of what she said and what she testified, it was worse. Anything she would have said would have been bad. But when she said, oh, the cost of health insurance, I'm worried about the cost of health insurance and whether she's going to get in there. Wow. Red light. Why? Because of the fact that this has been in national attention every day. Almost every employer has raised co-employees' benefits payments because of the fact that health care premiums have gone up as a result of whole health care costs. So we would submit to you that was entirely prejudicial. It should never have been allowed. And under Adams in that litany, should have been overruled and that the prejudice could not be sustained. I see I have 3.5 minutes reserved. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I will deal with the points in order. At the very end, I'm going to touch briefly on prejudgment interest. So far as the verdict being excessive, I don't plan to go through all the injuries. It's in all the briefs, and I went through it with the jury. I'll go over it if you want, but I think it's all set out in the briefs. I will say, in response to what counsel just said, one of the best witnesses for the plaintiff was Dr. Vera Papa, and his testimony, he was a defense examining doctor, and he agreed that this was a permanent condition, it was going to be painful, she was going to have it for the rest of her life. So, I mean, it's not like there was any contradiction in the evidence. Both the plaintiff's doctor and defense doctor said, you know, this is a young lady who has problems, and she's going to continue to have problems for 67 years. The important thing here, in my view, and I think Your Honor touched on, is the scope of review. The verdict they're attacking is insulated with two layers of discretion. One is the jury, which this court defers to by common law and constitution, and the second is that this court generally defers to a decision by the trial judge who confirms or modifies a verdict on the basis of whether it does or does not shock his or her conscience. The jury hears the evidence, sees the exhibits, makes a decision, the trial judge does the same thing. I don't know of any case anywhere, and particularly not in Delaware, where a reviewing court has set aside a decision of a trial judge who's passed on a motion for a new trial. In the reply brief, Sutton, at page 6, cites to the Burns and the Larimore cases, and they say flat out, quote, this court, unquote, meaning the Delaware Supreme Court set aside or revised a verdict. Were you about to say it? That's just not so. Larimore, a $30,000 verdict was set aside by the trial court, and this court said, you know, he heard the witnesses. We must therefore, perforce, refuse to disturb his findings. So this court did not reduce a verdict. And the same thing in Burns. The trial court, again, reduced the verdict and set up a remittiture. It wasn't this court. As to the golden rule argument, I don't think there was one. Normally the golden rule deals with damages, and the argument that I made was purely liability, and I'm not going to read it or anything unless you want me to. I'm sure you all have, but...
We've read it, but you're not suggesting that the rule is, with regard to negligence, that a golden rule argument would be proper, are you?
No, but I don't think I made it.
Well, that's two different things.
Yeah.
I think the first question is, And what should the law be? And the second is, if the law is that you can't argue the golden rule even with regard to negligence, is that the argument you made?
I don't think I did. The cases that I know about on golden rule, I'll deal with damages, though, however. But I mean, I see the logical follow-through that Your Honor is alluding to. But if you go to what I said, I mean, I just basically said, the court defined as any rate, well, I'm not going to read it. You've read it. But I mean, to me, it's not a golden rule argument. I just basically said.
Well, you said something to the effect, as I quoted earlier, that you and everyone who drives, you meaning the jury, mm-hmm. starts through the intersection when you see the green light.
And I don't think that's improper. I really don't. I mean, it seems to me that it's a reasonable man standard. You're not asking a jury to put themselves, per se, in the shoes of the plaintiff. You're just saying, this is what we all do. And to me, that's not improper. If it was, it was mooted by the fact that the jury found her contributory negligent. They found for the defendant on that issue. I was a little surprised that they found her contributory negligent, but they did. On the last point, unless you have more questions on that, any problem with Mrs. Vogt's testimony was cured by the trial court's instruction. And there's a long colloquy, and again, I'm not going to read it because it's at A249. The initial question, what are your concerns for Marie going forward? And there was an objection. And then that was overruled. And then Mrs. Vogt started talking about health insurance. Well, clearly that's not what I wanted. And when we got up to the sidebar, after Mr. Woods made his objection, I said, I don't have any problem with that. I wasn't looking for that answer. Something cautionary that the jury should disregard the statement as to what the health care carrier may do in the future is fine with me. This is at A251. And so the court said, all right. Mr. Woods said, all right. And then the court gave its cautionary instruction, and there was no further objection. I mean, he got the instruction he wanted. If he was unhappy with it, he should have said, you should say more. I mean, you just can't blindside a trial judge. So to the extent there was any error there, it was cured. I went on to my next question, and I rephrased the earlier one, which had been, I said, what are Marie's concerns for the future as she's conveyed them to you and as you perceive them to be? There was no objection to that. And I don't think the only objection I know of to that that could have been made would have been hearsay. Technically, she's, when I say that you perceive them to be, that has an aspect of hearsay, but there was no objection on that basis. So as the trial judge said in the footnote to his opinion, any error there was cured. And then the final thing is, and there's a footnote about prejudgment interest, and I don't know how you're going to decide it, but this is an issue that's floating around.
And did you take a cross appeal on that?
No, because it's never been decided.
Well, but if you want us to address it, you have
I don't want you to address it, Your Honor. But I would, if there's a remand and if you affirm in my favor, I would like the remand to direct to the trial judge to consider that. He, as late as this spring, there was some correspondence going back and forth with all of us as to whether or not he still had jurisdiction to decide it. And the last I heard, we got a letter saying it's ripe for decision, and then that's the last we heard. So if you do affirm the case, which I hope, then I would like the remand to ask the trial judge to consider that issue. But I realize it's not before you because it hasn't been decided below.
Very well.
Thank you.
On the golden rule argument, I'll draw your attention to our brief, where we cite to A325 and 326 and then on A328. And at the last of this portion, he says, Marie acted like all of us would act, like all reasonable people would act, and therefore she was not contributory negligent. That's the golden rule. That's it. No other question.
Respond to Mr. Elliott's argument that the jury obviously wasn't too impressed with that observation if they found her negligent.
Again, you look at whether they found her negligence the proximate cause of the accident, and that's And the answer to that interrogatory was no. And so there clearly you would say, well, given the facts of that, they put themselves in her position and said, look, I've done that myself 100 times. It might not be the most careful thing to do, but it didn't cause this accident. And that there's a dichotomy there that's not appropriate. I think that you've got to be careful of what you tell jurors. And again, the whole idea here is to keep them impartial and disinterested evaluators. And once you ask them to walk over that line, it's clear. And you can't just ask for liability purposes only. It goes for the whole thing. Because once there
Let me ask you one other question, and then in the short amount of time you have. Mr. Elliott argues the curative instruction regarding the mother's testimony was satisfactory, and if it wasn't, there should have been an amplification. What's your response?
Right. My response would be, first, if you look under Adams, you look at the fact that you look at the original ruling on the question, and the original ruling on the question was improper. It was improper because it doesn't matter what Mrs. Vogt's concerns were about her daughter. It's irrelevant, and it is not probative in any way. And it's going to elicit, clearly the question is going to elicit prejudicial evidence, and it's not going to be probative. And so that erroneous ruling led to the prejudicial statement. If you look at the colloquy involved, it was not lengthy at all. There was an objection made to a motion to strike the response, and there was a statement by counsel, and then the judge issued his instruction. He never, ever turned to counsel and said, is this okay to say this? Is this agreeable to all parties? He went and issued the instruction. You're under Hobson's choice of jumping up and down or not. The objection was sustained. It was overruled to the original question, and that's the problem. That's where the prejudice lies, because he did not appropriately exclude evidence which was not admissible, and then the testimony elicited afterwards so prejudicial, there's no way to wipe it out. The horse was out of the barn at that point. I would just say that the prejudgment interest is not before this court, and it was not appropriate to bring up here. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Clark, Mr. Elliott, and the court appreciates your argument. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.